The reading this evening is from Exodus 3, verses 1 through 6. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock back to the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked and beheld the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. Then he said, Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God.
Well, good evening. We continue our study of questions, and particularly our series within a series, Questions That God Asks Us. And we find our question this evening here in this context that Greg has just read for us. Whoa, what a story. You think about that. You know, sometimes we just read the Bible and it's like, yeah, I've heard that before. But you think about that. You know, here is Moses, 80 years old. 40 years ago, he thought he was something. 40 years ago, he thought he was ready to lead his people out of Egyptian bondage. As Stephen tells us in Acts chapter 7 in his last sermon, he thought he was going to be the deliverer, and they would surely understand that. He had, for all purposes, 40 years been preparing to be a leader. He had been a prince in Egypt and didn't turn out so well. Actually, that was 40 years ago. Now he's 80. 80 years he's been an obscure shepherd in an obscure land. And at 80, probably thinking about, retirement, if they did such a thing in those days, laying by, enjoying the golden years, maybe just suffering with his health out through the last few hard scrabble years of his life, I don't know. But 80, and then here, God speaks to him out of the burning bush. Stepped aside to see it. God says, and I don't know if God's spoken to him before this at all or not, said, I am the God of your fathers. And Moses is overwhelmed by that, I am sure. And of course, God calls him and says, I've got a big opportunity for you here. I've got a wonderful opportunity for you. I want you to go down to Egypt and tell the Pharaoh to let my people go. And Moses is not as full of confidence as he was when he was in the full strength of manhood at 40. He is like full of excuses, really. And he asks God three questions. He says to God, Who am I? Which is not the kind of question that he would ask 40 years ago, but things have changed considerably. Who am I? Go find somebody else. And then he says, What shall I say? What could anybody possibly say to Pharaoh to make him let those people go? And then he says, What if they don't believe me? What if they don't believe me? I go down and I tell the people, follow me. What if they don't believe me? And I guess he's harking back to that memory of how they didn't believe him before, when he had every reason to think that they would believe him. But now he's going to go down, an old man and a shepherd, and they have no knowledge of them at all. And he has no earthly standing or prestige. What if they don't believe me? And that's when God asks him a question. And really, in some ways, asks us a question too. And I'm almost embarrassed to deliver this sermon this evening, because it's what is that in your hand sermon. And that's probably been preached more times than any other sermon out of scriptures. But then on the other hand, what phrase in the Bible has not been preached over and over again? And what phrase in the Bible would it not behoove us to listen to once again a sermon about? What is that in your hand, God asking? In Exodus chapter 4 and verse 2. What is that in your hand, Moses? And he says, a staff. Now, one of the things that we don't have in the written word is the tone of voice with which these things are said. I'm not sure exactly how God spoke. Probably not quite like we've seen in the Cecil B. DeMille movies, but I'm not sure whether he says to Moses with compassion What's that in your hand, Moses? Or whether he says to him with some sense of, what's that in your hand, Moses? And I'm not sure how Moses says, this old thing, this staff, I'm not sure how he says that. But God says to him, throw it on the ground. And so he threw it on the ground and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand, grasp it by its tail. So he stretched out his hand and caught it. And it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. What is that in your hand? And I've often wondered if that's like a trick question. What's that in your hand? I don't know exactly the way in which Moses took that. He seems to have taken it straight value. He says, well, it's a staff in my hand. But it just seems like kind of a trick question. What's that in your hand? He used to have a scepter of power in his hand, and now it's just a shepherd's staff. If so, if that's the way the question is intended, it really is a question to point out his inadequacies, his failures. He's just another shepherd. This is just another staff. It's certainly not unusual or noteworthy in that time. Lots of people had staffs. And in fact, throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament, they had staffs. You remember maybe in Mark chapter 6 and verse 7, that when Jesus sent the apostles out on the limited commission and sent them out specifically, Mark says, that they would cast out unclean spirits, he said to them, don't take anything except a staff. And I wonder, I don't know. Did the apostles know their scriptures well enough to think to themselves, uh-oh, this is like that Moses story we know so well from Bible class, just a staff. But what is a staff? Really, I'm not sure. What Moses thought, is this an indication of my failure? No, I don't have a scepter of power in my hand like I used to. It's just a staff. I don't know. Maybe it's like a trick question when he asked him that. And he says, what you got in your hand? And Moses says, well, it's just a staff. And God says, throw it on the ground. It's not just a staff, it's a snake. All this time you've been carrying that, Moses, and it was a snake, and you didn't even know that. I don't understand about this question in some ways. What's that in your hand, Moses? And I do understand this part. Moses recognized a snake, and he had sense enough to flee from the snake. And God says, stop, go back over and pick it up. At least, fortunately, God said to him, pick it up by the tail. But that's a pretty big leap of faith by Moses to pick it up, even by the tail. And then when he picks it up, it's like a staff again. It's like, I don't know. What exactly is this thing I've had in my hand all this time? Maybe I didn't pay close enough attention when I picked this staff out. And I've always wondered a little bit the way Moses thought about that staff thereafter. You know, like you lean it up in the corner of the tent, at night. It's like, that'd be a little spooky, you know. That's not really a staff over there. That's like a snake that's just standing in the corner waiting his moment. I don't know how he thought about that. But I know this. It was a staff in his hand, and it seemed like just a staff. But when God says use it, then it becomes a pretty powerful tool. It's just a staff, a shepherd's staff. He carried it every day. He used it to direct the sheep. He used it to help himself to walk. He maybe used it to kill snakes on occasion. Next time he did that, he might think about it a little bit differently about that. It may have been a special staff to him. I don't know. It may be why God said, what do you have in your hand? It may have been that he'd picked this one out a long time ago. That he spent a lot of time shaping it in the evening hours, that it was worn smooth with the perspiration and the effort and the wear of his hand. It may have been a staff that was very special. Or it may have been one he just picked up and just replaced one that he used to like a lot. And he says, oh, this whole thing is just a staff. I don't know exactly the way he thought about that. But I know this, it had no spiritual meaning to him yet. No spiritual meaning to him yet, because it's going to take on a considerably different kind of feeling to him in his hand hereafter. Here is his opportunity, right here in his hand this whole time. He had wanted to lead his people out of bondage, and he couldn't do it 40 years ago. And now the time has come. And God says, I'm going to use that staff, and I'm going to use you, and I'm going to deliver my people from bondage, and I'm going to carry them into the promised land. Moses is a little bit full of fear and trepidation about that. But it's God who's going to do it. And it's God who's going to do it with a staff that looks just like any other shepherd's staff. Of course, I think there are probably many times this opportunity seemed pretty overwhelming to Moses. There are many times probably he thought to himself, I'd 100 times rather I had 1,000,000 sheep out here in the Sinai Desert than these Israelites. But it's God who's going to get that done with an insignificant shepherd's staff. And that's the key point, really, I think, of the lesson here that we're supposed to learn from this question, that without God is just a piece of wood. And, you know, you can't say there's anything special or magic about it. I know there, every once in a while, people are all excited about, maybe they've discovered the Ark. Sometimes they're maybe excited they discovered the Ark of the Covenant. And there are even times when they say, we've discovered the staff of Moses. And they're like, that's going to be really great when we find it. I don't know how they will prove that it is. I'm pretty sure that it is decayed long ago and rotted away in the nature of these sorts of things. I know this for sure. If they found it, they couldn't turn it into a snake. Not like God did. Because it had no power. No power till God gave it power. No power until God, until Moses trusted the power and trusted God's call. And you look what he did with that staff. What Moses, no, not Moses, what God did with Moses and with that staff. You read ahead a few chapters to Exodus chapter 7, and there were all of those plagues that were brought upon Egypt. And in particular, in Exodus chapter 7, in verses 17 and 19, it is the staff that plays a role in that plague. It is the staff that God says, you lift it up and hold it out over the river Nile, and I'll turn it into blood. And that's what Moses does, and it turns into blood. And then in chapter 8 and in verse 16, God says, particularly you hold that staff up, and I'm going to bring a swarm of gnats that are going to plague them. And the hail and the locust and all of these things came about. Not because there was any inherent power in the staff, but because God said to Moses, you hold it up, and when you hold it up in faith, I'm going to deliver this miracle. And so he did. And so God did. And then maybe the most impressive thing of all that God did with that staff was when they were finally let go by the Pharaoh. And they were coming up to the sea. And then Pharaoh changes his mind yet again. And he assembles his army and he rides in his chariot. And there are all kinds of chariots lined up next to him, thundering after these poor slave people who've wandered off. And here come his troops following along behind them. And the people cry out to Moses in Exodus chapter 14. And they say, why did you bring us out here? Here comes the Pharaoh. He's going to kill us and take us back. And here is Moses crying out to God. And in Exodus chapter 14 and verse 15, the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, you lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. And of course, this is like so monumental a miracle that the rationalists have to find some explanation for that, and they kind of redirect Moses and God's path from the sea over to what they call the reed marshes and say they marched through there and it was soft and mucky, but they were able to walk through. And then when the chariots came, it was boggy and they sunk down and they escaped that way. But that's not what happened. What happened was God said, you hold out your staff over the sea. And he held his staff out over the sea, and the winds parted the waters, and they walked through on dry land with the walls of water on either side of them. And when all of those people were through, and on the other side safely. Here comes Pharaoh, and he says, I'm going through too. And he gets into the middle, and God lets the waters collapse over them again. That's what happened with just a shepherd's staff. What do you have in your hand, Moses? A staff. This whole thing. I'm going to send you down to Egypt with that, and you're going to deliver my people. And even when they were in the wilderness, we're told in Exodus chapter 17 that there they were in the wilderness and there was no water for them because it was indeed a wilderness and water's a problem there. Some people even call it the Sinai Desert because there's so little water. And here's such a large number of people that they would have overwhelmed any of the ordinary watering spots around in the desert that the nomadic people knew about. And so they are crying out. And in Exodus chapter 17, verse 5, then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock and the water will come out of it. And the people may drink, and Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. Take in hand your staff. By now, Moses is like, yeah, I got it. I got it with this staff. I don't know if that plays any role in what happened in Numbers chapter 20 when it looked like Moses misused the staff. You remember, they wandered around for 40 years in this wilderness. And then there comes another time when they're murmuring and complaining and crying out for water. And in Numbers chapter 20 and verse 7, the Lord says to Moses, to these people, he says to Moses in Numbers chapter 20, verse 8, take the rod and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes that it may yield its water. And you shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock and let the congregation and their beasts drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? And then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and the beasts drank. And you note, of course, that there are a couple of things wrong with what Moses did. I don't know which of is the worse. I think they are part and parcel of the same thing. That he used language that wasn't really glorifying God as he ought to have when he says, must we bring forth water for you out of this rock? And he struck the rock with a staff twice. Now, before God had used the staff to strike the rock to bring water out, I don't know whether Moses is like, he said, speak to him, but, you know, I got a whole lot more confidence in this staff than I have in speaking to the rock, and then he made a supposition that he ought not to have made. And I don't know which is worse, that he didn't give God the glory in the language that he used, or that he invented a way to use the staff and put more trust in the staff than he did in God. But both cases, either way you think of it, he did not glorify God. And for that reason, God denied him the promised land. What is that you have in your hand, Moses? It's a staff. It's just a staff. Oh, but it's much more than a staff when you trust God. It's much more than a staff when God chooses to use it. But don't put too much confidence in the staff, Moses. Your trust needs to be in God. No matter what it is, we can always put more trust in the things that we have than we do in God. And that's a misuse of what we have. Of course, the principle that most people draw out of this question, what in your hand, is sometimes called the what is in your hand principle. And the what is in your hand principle in Scripture is no matter what you have in your hand, no matter how insignificant it may seem, God can use it to accomplish His work. And there are myriad of examples of that sort of principle throughout the Scriptures. Many others that you could think of. not so much in specific that God said to them, what's in your hand, and then here's what you're going to do with what's in your hand. But you see, over and over, those men of faith who accomplished great things, even with what seemed insignificant that was in their hand. David, of course, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, takes just a shepherd's sling and five smooth stones, and really it only took one, and he defeats the champion of the Philistines, Goliath, who had held off all the mighty men of Saul. What's that in your hand, David? Just a sling. Ah, but look what God could do with Moses' staff. And look what God did with the sling and the arrows of a man of faith. And Shamgar, with an ox goad, became the deliverer of Israel in Judges chapter 3 and verse 31. The Philistines, the scourge of the Middle East in those days. The Philistines who had themselves iron and steel, and they used swords and spears that had those metals in them and denied them to everybody else. What have you got in your hand, Shamgar? Just an ox goad. And probably his ox goad isn't even metal. It's probably just sharpened wood that's been hardened in the fire. And yet God used Shamgar and his ox goad to deliver the Israelites. You look on into the New Testament, and here comes the story in John chapter 6. 5,000 hungry people, and the little boy has 5 loaves, 2 fishes. What do you have in your hands? 5 loaves, 2 fishes. What's that among so many? But look what God was able to do with that, because he brought them and gave them to Jesus. Look in Luke chapter 21. Here's the woman who looks around at all of those wealthy people who are making contributions to the treasury. And I presume they were like those people that Jesus condemned there in the Sermon on the Mount. They were blowing their trumpets and getting people's attention as they cast their huge sums of money into the offering box. Some of them probably really in some ways giving sacrificial offerings to God. Many of the others only giving what they had stolen from their parents, as Jesus condemns them in Matthew chapter 23. And here's this woman over by the column, furtively waiting until nobody's looking. And then she goes and puts her 2 copper coins into the offering box. And Jesus, who's been watching all of this with his apostles, says, look, that woman has given more than all the rest put together. What's that you have in your hand? Just 2 copper coins. And yet 2 copper coins. Becomes an eternal lesson in generosity and the work of the Lord. In every one of these stories, we have this what's in your hand kind of principle. Ordinary people taking the ordinary things that they have in their hands, nothing special about that, and using it for God's purpose. You know, it's really kind of interesting, too, that sometimes God puts into our hands the things that he wants us to use. We are really kind of empty-handed until God puts it there and then says, now I want you to use it. I don't know, it kind of seems that's the implication of the story in Judges chapter 15 of Samson. Samson, of course, has all kinds of talents and all kinds of abilities, the strongest man in the Bible. Maybe the dumbest too, well, maybe not quite, but the strongest man in the Bible. But Samson, you know, is in a real pickle there in Judges chapter 15. Because he's already been in combat with the Philistines. They're upset, so they're coming to Judah to take him. And his own fellow tribesmen, they arrest him, they tie him up, and they take him to the Philistines. In Judges chapter 15, when they came to Leah, the Philistines shouted as they met him. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that the ropes that were on his arms were as flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds dropped from his hands. And yet there's this whole army of Philistines. And he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. So he reached out and he took it, and he killed 1,000 men with it. And Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've killed 1,000 men. And when he'd finished speaking, he threw the jawbone from his hand, and he named that place Ramathaleah. And then he became very thirsty, and he called to the Lord, and he said, you've given him great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? But God split the hollow place that is in Leah, so that the water came out of it, and when he drank, his strength returned, and he revived. And therefore he named it Anhakaror, which is Leah to this day. And of course, here's a story that is miraculous. So many levels, it is a miraculous story. And yet in some ways, the question is the same. What's in your hand, Samson? Nothing. Well, here's the jawbone, Samson. What can you do with that? Kill 1,000 Philistines, 1,000 of the enemies of God's people, and provide deliverance on that day. The story of the miracles, of course, suggests to us maybe that doesn't have anything at all to do with us. Because God's probably not going to split up in any rocks and feed us with water when we're thirsty. Although maybe it's more miraculous the way in which he has fed us and taken care of us and provided us with clean water and all the good things that we enjoy in our life. But I think in some ways, the story in which there are miracles clearly displays to us what God is doing. When sometimes in our own lives, we don't see it so clearly. It's not so obvious to us what God is doing. We don't know what God is doing today as clearly as we know what he was doing in those days, at least in those times when he tells us those specific stories to reveal it to us. But I can guarantee you, most of the people of Samson's day, most of the people of Moses' day, they didn't know any more clearly than we do what God's plans were. But he's done those things, and he's told us in detail what he was doing and how he did it, so that when we live in this day and age, we may believe. Because as Jesus says in John 5, verse 17, my Father is working till now, and I myself am working. God is still working. And he still really, in some way, says, you know, what's in your hand? And how do we know? Whether that's not the questions being asked us, in some ways, implicitly, even this very day. Esther chapter 4 and verse 14, you remember the story of Esther and how Mordecai says to Esther, who knows whether you've attained to royalty for such a time as this? Who knows but whether you're right here at this moment, this time, for just such a moment as this? Who knows that what you have in your hands at this moment, two mites or the jawbone of a donkey or a staff, were not put there just for this moment, that you might do something in God's plans for this. God would say to us today, what is in your hand? What is in your hand? At any moment in time, God might speak and say, what is in your hand? And then we would look. And what would we say? Maybe think about this. Would we be embarrassed at some point in time if he said, what is in your hand? And maybe it's your brother or sister's toy you're not supposed to have. What's in your hand? Or maybe some ill-gotten gain. Or maybe it's the hand of some person we ought not to be having anything to do with. Or maybe it's some unsavory book or activity. What's in your hand? All the examples in the Bible, of course, where we can see in detail, and God has told us what he did with ordinary people and the ordinary things they had in their hand. It was at least legitimate things they had in their hand. No matter how plain or how simple it was something that they ought to have had in their hands. It was something it wasn't wrong to have in their hands. What do we have in our hands? Hopefully it's not embarrassing. Hopefully it is legitimate. Maybe it doesn't seem like very much. Sometimes, of course, we want to do great things. And that's wonderful that we want to do great things. That we want to do great things for the Lord. But we're not all going to be able to do great things. Sometimes what we're called on to do are smaller things. Because God uses the simple things in life to accomplish the great things, little by little, as he adds them all together. In ways that we don't know. Maybe sometimes we look back and we look at our life and see the way it's added together. Maybe we look back and see how the lives of a number of people have added together or a congregation. But often we just don't know. Proverbs 14 and verse 24 says, "The eyes of the fool are on the end of the earth." It is the fool who always is planning big things and never gets anything done. You got to do the little things if you're going to get the big things done. And it may seem like we don't have, you know, really great opportunities to do great things. We don't even have much in our hand. But there are always three things that we have in our hands that may seem insignificant, but can really amount to a lot if we put it in the Lord's hands and if we trust Him. The kind of things we can do for other people, the prayers that we can offer, and the time that we have, those all belong to us. A beat up car can be about God's work. A small salary and contribution can support great preaching. Humble prayers delivered in privacy that nobody ever hears can reach God's ears and accomplish great things. A kind word doesn't take very much time. It doesn't cost us anything. And yet it may be exactly what someone needs to hear, and it may do more good than we will ever know. What is in your hand? Hopefully, not something embarrassing. Hopefully, however insignificant it may seem, it is the Lord's and ready for the Lord's use. There's another way in which we may think of this question too. What's in your hand? It may also mean responsibility. What do you have, and what are you going to do with it? What do you have in your hands, and what are you going to do with those things that you have? Or maybe not things, maybe people, parents. What's in your hand? A child. Small, older, what's in your hands, and what are you going to do with that child? Or what about those of us who are older and yet married, don't have children, or maybe we're younger, married? What's in your hand? A husband? A wife? You know, what is in your hand? And what kind of responsibility is that? What are you going to do with that? I thought about that. George Jones' song came to my mind. Maybe not the most savory kind of situation, but it makes the point. See that girl over there by the jukebox? Hear the lonely song she plays? Well, you ask me if I know why she's crying. I know a little. I made her that way. Just another country music song about a failed relationship. What do we have in our hands? Young people? What do you have in your hands? Maybe not responsibility for anyone else at this point in time, but you got a responsibility for yourself. You got your time. You got your strength. You got your beauty. You got whatever kind of talents it may be. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 1, after the wise man debates with himself about what value is life, he comes to a final conclusion about that. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 1, "Remember also the Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near when you say, 'I have no delight in them.'" Well, even those of us who are getting close to that period of time, what do you have in your hands? There are a lot of people looking up to see how the end of life is. How do you handle those days? What do you have in your hand? And what are you doing with it for God's service? It could be positive, you know. There could be something useful done with whatever it is that we have, no matter how insignificant it may seem. That's what the song, There's Room in the Kingdom, suggests about what we have. J.R. Baxter wrote those words because he's thinking about what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 25, when he looks at the judgment day and he separates the goats and the sheep, and he says to those on his right, he says, "Enter in to the reward that was for you from the foundation of the earth." And they said, "You know, why?" And he said, "Because you gave me a cup of cold water." And he said, "When did we ever see you hungry, thirsty, naked, do those things for you? Whenever you did it for the least of these, you did it for me." J.R. Baxter takes those words and he says, there's room in God's kingdom, my brother, for the small thing that you can do. Just a kindly deed that you may cheer another is the work God has planned for you. Just a cup of cold water in his name given. May the hope in some heart renew. What's in your hand? And really think about it this way. What's in your hand? It's not what's in somebody else's hand. This is what's in our hand. Not a matter of whether somebody else has something greater or less than we have. What's in your hand? That's what you're responsible for. You remember in John chapter 21, Jesus' last meeting apparently with Peter and John, and the apostles all gathered together, and he's talking to Peter about what he wants him to do. In John chapter 20 and verse 21, Peter looks over and he sees John and he says to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? And Jesus said to him, if I want him to remain till I come, what's that to you? You follow me. Doesn't matter what's in somebody else's hand. Doesn't matter whether it's more than we have or less than we have. Doesn't matter if it's different. What is in your hand? That's the question that God asks us. And don't forget to take it with you in your service for the Lord. Back to the story of Moses. Exodus chapter 4 and verse 17. After God's gone through these exercises with him and he finally convinces Moses, you need to go and take the staff and do my work. He says to him in Exodus 4 and verse 17, and you shall take the rod in your hand with which you shall do the signs. Don't forget that. And in Exodus 4 and verse 20, then Moses took his wife and his sons and he set them on a donkey and he returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand. And you note the subtle distinction there? It is no longer his staff. It's God's staff. And it's God's staff not because there's some inherent spirituality in the staff. It's not God's staff because he's imbued it with some special kind of power. It is God's staff because Moses has entrusted God with everything that he has and everything that he is. He takes his children and he takes his wife and he takes the staff. What's in your hand, Moses? A staff. And it now belongs to God. It's no longer his, but it's God's. And so it is with us if we're going to be effective in his kingdom. And isn't that what God told the rich young ruler when he said to him, go sell everything you have and give it to the poor and come follow me? That's all God asks of us, just whatever's in our hands. It all belongs to him if we're to follow the example of the what's in your hand principle and accomplish anything in the kingdom of the Lord. It's because what's in our hand is now in his hands. That's the only way it's going to be effective. That's the only way we're going to be effective. That's what Peter said in Mark chapter 10 and verse 28. Behold, we've left everything and followed you. Well, left everything in the sense that it was no longer important so long as we have Jesus in our lives. And I am thankful that we're here this evening and that we are here to worship God through Jesus Christ. I'm thankful that Jesus is here in our midst because he's promised to be wherever two or three are gathered together in his name. I'm thankful for whatever little things he puts in our hands that we know that he can do great and wonderful things with them. Though they may seem small to us and insignificant, and our lives may seem relatively insignificant, they are not in the kingdom. I'm thankful that we're here together. And if you're here this evening and you're not given what's in your hand and given yourself indeed to Jesus, then you need to do that while he is here and while he invites you to come. And we stand and sing this song to encourage you.